Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. This is Rob Lamb.
And I am Joe McCormick. And today on Weird House Cinema, we are going to be talking about the famous slash infamous 1988 Polish science fiction epic On the Silver Globe, directed by Andrzej Żuławski. I first became interested in this movie by reading about it. Several film critics and historians that I came across characterized On the Silver Globe kind of like the final boss of weird movies as like the ultimate Mac Daddy of weird, difficult, fascinating films. And it's been described in a lot of superlative terms. It's one of the most beautiful, one of the ugliest, one of the most astounding, one of the most exhausting and utterly bizarre, intensely compelling and impossible to follow films ever made. And having seen it now, I have to agree with all of that. I found this film both amazingly interesting and tiring and difficult to the point of annoyance. I have such strong reactions in multiple directions to it, but I'm really glad we saw it. And I think it's a film that most people should try to see if they can at some point. Just be prepared. You are in for a very long, very tiring, highly confusing experience, but it's also extremely rewarding.
I do want to add a caveat here that it is, and this is all subjective, of course, it's never boring. And it is also not when we talk about films that are, you know, sometimes challenging to watch, this film is not a film that is cruel. It's not a film that is like daring you to watch it or anything of that nature. I mean, there's some grisly moments. There are some, there are some bloody moments. But it's not one of those films that like has it in for the audience. It wants the audience to go on the journey with it.
Right. It is a movie that's difficult, but not because it's like wall to wall torture scenes. Though there are some. There are some scenes of physical pain and trauma, but that's not what the movie is largely about. So despite the enormous runtime of this movie, I think the cut that I saw, which I think is the main cut available, was 166 minutes. Was that yours, Rob?
I believe so, yes.
So very long movie, 2 hours and 46 minutes. Wrong. Mm-hmm. Am I doing the math right there? Yeah,
I believe so. 244, 246, something like that. It is. It's not even close. It is the longest movie that we have watched for Weird House Cinema.
And despite that massive runtime, this film is technically unfinished, as the original production in the 1970s, we can talk more about the production process as we go on, but when they were originally shooting this movie, it was shut down by Polish authorities in the year 1977, with roughly 20% of the movie yet to be filmed, had not been filmed yet. And I understand that at one point, what was shot, the 80% we have, was supposed to have been destroyed, but by some miscommunication or stroke of luck, it was not. And then roughly a decade after the production was halted, the still existing pieces of the movie were put together by the director, by Andrzej Żuławski, with the gaps patched over by voiceover narration. And in a strange choice, but one that I think actually works quite well tonally, it's kind of hard to explain exactly why, modern documentary footage unrelated to the plot of the film is just shown while the director is explaining what happens in the unfilmed scenes.
Yeah, that is an interesting choice, because I've seen other unfinished or partially lost films where they'll stitch things together with, say, storyboards or illustrations or something to that effect. So this is a choice that at first seemed rather jarring. I'm like, what are we doing? What's happening? Why are we in contemporary Polish urban environment here? Mm-hmm. Is this supposed to be a world of the film? No, it is not a world in the film. It is, but it is not also completely disconnected from the film. So it ultimately ends up working, like you're saying, but it is a unique choice.
Often somehow the documentary film that's paired with the voiceover narration seems to connect in a feeling way to what's mm-hmm. going on, even if it doesn't connect in a concrete way. Like, there'll be a scene where something is being uncovered and there is kind of the documentary camera seems to uncover something in a way.
Yeah. And it's, and as we'll be discussing, there is often a kind of documentary point of view, almost found footage vibe to the camera work in the movie proper.
Oh, yeah.
And so that connects nicely, I think, with this added footage of these European streets. I'm not sure offhand if these, I'm assuming Polish, but it could have been, these could be French streets, because I know Żuławski spent time in France as well.
Well, even the original footage of the movie, like the first third of the movie, is like the Blair Planet Project. You know, it's filmed via, not exactly clear what the sci-fi devices are, but there's like video diaries. So we get tons of point of view shots.
Mm-hmm. And the memory of the video diaries and so forth.
Yeah.
And then there's just a lot. There are extensive monologues that are about like the voyeuristic quality of film, because you have characters in the film that are filming things and recording things and documenting things. And one character in particular, the old man, ends up ruminating on this for a while. Like, what does it mean that I don't speak, but I absorb, and so forth. So there's a lot in the film that seems to be speaking to a director / creator's experience. And then we see that reflected back into these bits about the lost portions of the film.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are parts where when the characters are looking into one of the other characters' faces as they're recording a so-called video diary, like one of them sort of tries to direct for them. They say, mm-hmm. like, turn it off now, you fools. This is not the right time, or something.
Yeah.
But then there's another thing that connects to that about the sort of meta filmmaking themes of the movie. Is how many characters throughout the plot are described as actors.
Yeah.
This is a recurring theme that, like, it'll make more sense once we describe the plot that exists, but there's like a society that emerges on another planet as it is colonized by humans. And it seems that a major function within the emerging society is that of an actor, somebody who says, I'm an actor, I'm playing a role. And they'll like look into the camera at certain moments and say, how do you like my acting?
Yeah. In this kind of bohemian, pagan, post-apocalyptic society that emerges on this alien world, we see important roles set aside for, of course, martyrs and saviors, but also ultimately filmmakers and prophets and actors.
And presumably the designers of parade floats, because we get those too.
Yeah.
So we'll probably talk a bit more about the production of the movie in a bit here, but just to say at the beginning, the production was quite famously intense, expensive, and challenging. It, I think, demanded a lot of the actors and crew. There are some reports that like it was a rewarding but grueling experience. It was very expensive and lavish. It was like an extravagant production. They shot in many different locations all over the place, from the Gobi Desert to the Baltic coast of Poland and places in between, I think in the Caucasus Mountains. It was just it's supposedly incredibly intense. And then it was brought to a conclusion before they had actually finished making the movie, because the Polish authorities shut it down for some reason. There is dispute about what that reason actually was. Like, was it related to supposedly subversive themes of the film that the authorities were uncomfortable with? Was it related to them going over budget and just like it being too expensive? Or was it one article I was reading, I don't know how seriously this suggestion is made, but there's a very good article about the movie you can look up in Film Comment magazine by a writer named Jonathan Romney, who mentions, first of all, that that On the Silver Globe is sort of one of the defining examples of a film maudit, in the French expression, M-A-U-D-I-T, meaning a cursed film, a film that just like doesn't really belong in this world. In fact, Romney says that it's a film maudit made by a director who seemed to specialize in making film maudit. But also he mentions the possibility that it could have been shut down just because people were looking at this and like, people can't take like 40 more minutes of this movie. You know, even the 80% we have is 166 minutes long, and it's so intense. It's going to be amazing if people sit through this whole thing and can take it in all at once.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can imagine that some of the more subversive qualities, and there's plenty of places you can point to in the film that these may have been some definite contributing factors to the order to destroy the film. Because of course it's one thing to cancel something for going over budget, but to say actually we want this erased from the world. And again, like you said, thankfully that effort was not fruitful.
So what we're left with is, in my opinion, a really, truly fascinating artifact. Not necessarily something that's going to be fun viewing for your regular movie night. Like, you need to commit. You need to know what you're getting into with this one. But if you're willing to go there, it is an amazing film. It exhibits at once a weird genius and a deep passion. Like, for all of the, you know, we'll have some things to say about this movie's almost random feeling philosophical monologues, but it is clearly a movie made with deep feeling. The feeling is just pouring out of it, and it's hard not to be infected by some of that. Also, just the textural genius of it, all of the costumes and the sets and the visual composition is just amazing. But it also does have a kind of artistic belligerence to it. Like, it is, Rob, you mentioned that it's not a movie that's like, you know, trying to harm the audience by just showing them gross torture scenes and all that. I agree it is not like that, but it is kind of a belligerent film. Like, in a way, it is challenging your attention to single combat.
Yeah, it is a film that will philosophically berate you, and you want to take it all in. You're like, this, because the acting scenes in which we get these extended monologues, they're often just amazing. Like, the energy of the performance and the severity of the performance is just so enthralling. But it is kind of a struggle at times to really follow all the threads that are going on there.
In that article in Film Comment, Jonathan Romney describes sort of a set of films that don't feel like they belong in our world, that feel like they sort of come from another place. And he writes, quote, "Adhering neither to familiar screen aesthetics nor to the customary logic of filmmaking economics, they present themselves as free-floating, lawless bodies, autonomously occupying their own sectors of the filmic cosmos." And I think that nails it. That's what this movie feels like. It is a free-floating, lawless body.
Yeah, I mean, it is difficult to compare this to other films, and certainly almost impossible to try to make it adhere to the laws of other films and to the framework of other films. It has its own vibe, its own rules, and you can't fault it for following that that pathway. So yes, this is indeed a Polish film. And in fact, it is our first Polish film on Weird House Cinema. And I have to say, it might also be my first purely Polish film viewing experience, you know, not counting like co-productions and, of course, various films with Polish talent or Polish, authorship and so forth. So we can put another pin in the map and another apology to France. We'll get to weird French movies eventually. So often we'll throw in an elevator pitch here. I don't know that an elevator pitch can really do this film justice. So we might have to skip that. But it is an epically weird film in multiple ways. So it is a fitting pick for Weird House Cinema.
It's kind of an alternate Book of Genesis set on another planet, like a sci-fi Book of Genesis, or maybe it's bigger than Genesis. Maybe it's like the whole Bible set on another planet. it's really got everything. It's got saviors and prophets and strife and conquest and loss and it's got it all.
Yeah, and aliens. It's got some really cool aliens.
Yeah.
In a way, it reminds me a little bit of Paradise Lost. Only instead of trying to justify the ways of God to man, it's trying to justify the ways of man to God by shouting at God.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, let's go ahead and listen to some trailer audio. This is from, I'm honestly not sure if this is in any way an original trailer. This one is posted by the Austin Film Society. This might be more aligned with a recent re-release of the film, which I'll mention here in a bit. But it should give you some flavor, and you'll get to hear some of the Polish language of this film.
Are we going to hear one of the Sherns talking?
Yes, we will hear a Shern. So that gives you just a little taste, but insufficient, because this is a film full of sights and sounds that they just have to be absorbed over the course of nearly 3 hours. And even the language itself, again, I don't think I'd watched anything in the Polish language before, a film in the Polish language before. And this is there's a lot of Polish language to absorb here, watching it in Polish with English subtitles. And as is often the case, you know, like the rhythm and the poetry of the language seeps into you, even if you don't, you know, understand it, even as you're reading it along with the dialogue and these performances.
Yeah, obviously I don't speak Polish, but there were little moments where like a word I would recognize would like hit and lock in. Like there were many points in the movie where somebody would place huge emphasis on the word Pravda, meaning truth.
Yeah.
And there were a few things like that. The Polish word for earth, which I forget now, there are parts where that is sort of repeated emphatically and kind of burns in.
Yeah, so that's always an interesting experience in a foreign language film. All right, if you would like to see On the Silver Globe before we proceed here, well, you can get it. That's the good news. However, as of this recording, there's sadly neither a current legit streaming option or a Region A or Region Free disc, as far as I'm aware of. But the film has been restored in HD. Eureka Video in the UK put out a great-looking Region B Blu-ray with a bunch of extras. Well, I think we have heard that a Region A or some sort of region-free release might be on the way.
Yeah.
But I don't know the details on that or who's putting it out.
I hope they do. I mean, I know this movie has been shown in screenings at art house theaters and stuff in recent years, but I don't know who is actually working on a disc release that can be seen on all your regular players in the U.S. But yeah, I hope that's coming soon.
Yeah, yeah. So you watched this on a disc rented from Videodrome, and I ended up just watching it on YouTube just because that's the best way I could get it. And it ended up getting really good film quality. But of course, none of that is guaranteed when you're depending on like YouTube rips of movies. So I'm still looking forward to a proper Region A or Region Free release in the future. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right. Well, let's talk a bit about some of the people involved here. And in doing so, we'll sort of also go through some of the main characters, I guess, before getting into the plot. Starting here at the top with Andrzej Żuławski, the director and the writer, screenplay credit on this. He lived 1940 through 2016, Ukrainian-born Polish director and writer who made a career of really going against the mainstream and state sensibilities, appealing ultimately more to art house tastes, while also working with some of the biggest names in Polish cinema. He studied cinema in France and then served under Polish director Andrzej Wajda, and he directed a pair of 1969 TV movies, which I'll come back to. And then he directed a film titled The Third Part of Night in 1971. I haven't seen this one, but I've read that it's a rather intense and horrific Holocaust drama with various dreamlike elements to it.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1972, he's credited with directing two episodes of the Polish Christopher Lee-hosted horror anthology series Theater Macabre, though these two episodes that he directed seem to be the same short films from 1969, so they might have just been repackaged for TV anthology usage, which, of course, is not unheard of with horror anthology series in general.
Was Christopher Lee hosting an exclusively Polish show, or is this a show that aired in multiple countries?
No, this was a Polish horror anthology series. And, you know, they were able to get Christopher Lee to come in, probably similar to what we were talking recently about a small-scale Canadian production that brought in Vincent Price to do something similar. So they probably brought him in for like a day, and he recorded stuff. And,
yeah, they shot all his segments, and then they just spaced him out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would make sense.
And perhaps repackaged some already existing films and commissioned some other short works. So, yeah, I'd love to hear from anyone, any of our Polish listeners or listeners with access or memories of Polish television. Perhaps you can provide more information about this.
1972, I think that would have been right around the time of The Wicker Man, by the way. Wicker Man was maybe, what, 73?
Oh, yeah.
So you're getting that Christopher Lee, which is, all the Christopher Lees are great, but that's the best one, I think.
Mm-hmm. All right, so after this, Zawoski follows it up with the 1972 historical satanic horror film, The Devil. And I also have not seen this one, but apparently there's plenty in here to poke Polish authorities, because they ended up banning the film in Poland. And in the midst of this, Zawoski moves to France.
I heard it described as him being basically exiled.
Yeah, yeah. It was too much. So he ends up going to France after this. He makes the 1975 French romance drama, That Most Important Thing, Love. And he returned to Poland for his next project, which is, of course, the ambitious adaptation of his grandfather's science fiction novels. This is On the Silver Globe, shot between 1976 and 1977.
Yeah, so from what I understand, On the Silver Globe is the title of the first of a cycle of three science fiction novels that Zawoski's grandfather wrote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Lunar Trilogy.
Yeah.
And a little more on the grandfather here in just a minute. So we've already discussed the problems with this production, and we'll probably touch on it a bit more. Needless to say, the film does not come out in the late 70s. It's going to be another decade before it comes out. After, for a while, it may seem that it is completely lost. So, but he keeps moving on. You know, he's going to keep making films. So Zawoski, after this point, makes what might be his best known film internationally. One that I think, if you've spent any amount of time like I have, like rummaging around in video rental stores, you've probably seen the box art for this one, because it has like an illustration of a Gorgon, of a Medusa on the cover. This is the 1981 psychosexual horror film Possession.
I've never seen this, but I've heard I've heard it described actually in kind of similar terms, like intense and difficult, but very good.
Yeah. Yeah. It stars French actress Isabelle Anjani, Sam Neill, and German actress Margit Karstensen. And yeah, I was reading a little bit. I haven't seen this one either. I'm just familiar with it by reputation. And I did see some interview segments from Sam Neill and also from Adjani, who were pointing out that, yeah, this was a rewarding but grueling acting experience that they're glad they did when they were younger. And then, and these are like, you know, a decade or two old interviews. So we're not dealing with like, you know, current Sam Neill reflecting on a film from the 80s. This is like 90s or early 2000s Sam Neill reflecting on a film he did.
I'm in my Jurassic Park era. Jurassic Park and Event Horizon. I can't do stuff like Possession anymore. Where we're going, we won't need eyes to make films.
Yeah. So this was Zawoski's only English language film, and it was a French-West German co-production. He followed it up with the French drama The Public Woman in 84, Mad Love in 85, though this is not related to any other film with the title Mad Love. and then after this point, On the Silver Globe was finally released in the more or less in the form that we experienced it in.
Yeah, so the way he describes it, because he, you know, it's funny, the version of On the Silver Globe we have is mostly just a reconstruction of the film with these patches filled in with the modern documentary footage and Zuofsky himself narrating the missing scenes. But it's also, I don't know, like 2% a documentary. Like there are parts where he just talks about what happened with the film, especially at the beginning and the end. So he has like a monologue at the beginning that we'll get to when we get to the plot section. But I think toward the end, he talks a bit about what happened with the film. Doesn't he say that, you know, all of the costumes and the sets and everything were destroyed, but that maybe some people were able to hide a few, to get a few of them away?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And then in the towards the very end, too, we see his reflection in like a window or some glass on the street and I don't know, in Poland or France, wherever he's walking around here. So we get this mirror glimpse of the director, which I thought was quite perfect for this portion of the film.
And at the end, he kind of bolts away. Doesn't he?
So after On the Silver Globe was finally released, he would direct 6 more films, the last being 2015's Cosmos, a French-Portuguese thriller that apparently does have some fantastic elements, so I'm not sure if we're talking like magical realism or sci-fi, but I think it doesn't seem to be defined as a purely speculative picture or anything. Mm-hmm. All right, so that is the director, Andrzej Żuławski. But then we have Jerzy Żuławski, his grandfather. This is the author who wrote the Lunar Trilogy upon which this is based. He lived 1874 through 1915. He wrote the Lunar Trilogy between the years of 1901 and 1911. So these serve as, at least in large part, basis for the film. Though this adaptation certainly seems to update the lunar setting and replace it with an alien world. We often see this with older science fiction that has been translated into latter decades, where we have a different understanding of what the cosmos has in store for us. Mm-hmm. And the trilogy was apparently, pretty successful. It was beloved by a wide Polish readership, including Polish sci-fi writer Stanisław Lem of Solaris fame. And it's also available in English translation. I'm not sure at what point it enters English translation, but it is out there right now, and you can pick it up in most formats. Jerzy Żuławski's career was cut short as he died of typhus during World War I, and this stands out as his most well-known work.
Did you read anything about what motivated Andrzej to adapt his own grandfather's novel? Like, why was he interested in doing that? I didn't come across that, but it seems like a good question.
I didn't run across a particular reason, but I understand that he had long wanted to do it. Like he felt obviously a connection to his grandfather and his grandfather's work. But at the same time, it's the adaptation seems to. From what I can tell, it's true to a lot of the elements of those books, but also has this additional philosophical content and also commentary on creativity and being a director that do seem to originate more with the director here.
And by philosophical content, I assume there you are referring in large part to this film's monologues. It's bold, all caps, 32-point font monologues about, if one acts, one has roots. And, I pulled a couple of quotes in here. Here's one. I will feel in me your inhuman translucence. I will feel your incomprehensible breath, your absolute coldness. Stuff about how like my identity is now you and your identity has penetrated my identity and we have become you. I think we got to talk about the actors because they are the ones screaming these lines in the surf.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a film where pretty much every performance is just this existential waltz at the edge of sanity.
Yeah.
It actually put in my mind, I believe it was a Fresh Air interview that I heard recently with the actor Emma Stone, contemporary actor Emma Stone, who was recently in the excellent weird movie Poor Things, but she was talking about like the rigors of acting and about like afterwards the actor will feel often emotionally drained. They need to sort of like come down, reprocess. They may be just physically tired, if not from anything they're doing like physically in terms of stunts or anything, but just from like the raised levels of excitement in the body while having to embody these, you know, sometimes, you know, often extreme states of human emotion and behavior.
Yeah. When you perform intense emotion deliberately to play a role, in many ways that it convinces your brain and your body that you're actually having those emotions. And so you can't just like turn it off easily after the scene's over. For a lot of actors, you can't. So there's sort of you've got to ramp up and then you've got to coast back down after it's over.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is a lot of times, I mean, that's often going on, if not always going on in film. But sometimes it's invisible. This is a movie where it's almost impossible to ignore that reality, especially as these characters are giving these like these just high intensity extended monologues whilst, you know, being waist deep in the water or wallowing in the mud or you know, or they're naked or they're, you know, covered in blood or some other kind of, you know, additional factor is involved here that really just drives home like, wow, this was a commitment.
I think most of the main cast in this movie is very good, but I don't think there, with maybe one exception, there really aren't subtle performances. Mm-hmm. There, I mean, this is a movie where it's fever pitch with almost everybody all the time.
That's right. And the really one of the best examples of this is ultimately our central character. This is Andre Severin, who plays Merrick. Merrick is a second wave astronaut from Earth who is received on the alien world as a savior and is ultimately, I guess, our central character. Severin was born in 1946, Polish actor of stage and screen, as well as a director. He is considered one of the greatest Polish actors of all time, highly decorated and respected. His credits go back to 1965, still active today. Most of his credits are Polish or French films, including 1980's The Conductor, starring Sir John Gielgud, and Golem from the same year. He also appears in 1993's Schindler's List, which features several Polish actors. It's a supporting role, but it's, you know, it's, you know, in the top like six or seven credits when you look at the film's listing on the various movie databases. Mm-hmm. He was also part of the international cast for Peter Brook's epic adaptation of the Mahabharata, playing the part of Yudhisthira, one of the Pandava brothers, and a central character in that. That is also, that, you know, in a way, you could compare this production, that particular production, with On the Silver Globe, because that is a very long adaptation of an epic that contains, in this case, a number of international actors from various countries. But they're often engaging in extended monologues that are very deep and at times challenging to follow in full. Mm-hmm. So Severin here, spends a lot of screen time at or toppling over that edge of sanity. And even the less extreme emotional parts of the performance are, he is at least emotionally naked, sometimes actually naked. And this is definitely one of those performances, perhaps aided by the close proximity we are to it. So many of these monologues, there is a sense that the actor is not just speaking into the middle distance, like they are speaking at you. They're like sort of clawing their way as if trying to emerge from this world and this picture into your living room or into your cinema, et cetera.
In that article and film comment I mentioned, Jonathan Romney, speaking of multiple characters doing these kinds of high-intensity performances, but I think he probably has Severin most front of mind when he says this, quote, "The performances are flamboyantly incantatory or declamatory, as if each actor is addressing an audience positioned somewhere over the brow of yonder hill. Much agonized screaming and mad laughter is called for as the actors deliver grandly philosophical or religiose discourse." And then a few sentences later, "Bear in mind that much of this dialogue is shouted, even screamed, by actors sometimes drenched in blood or standing waist high in the sea."
One of the Videodrome gang on Letterboxd, a guy by the name of John, commented that he, quote, "kept expecting Klaus Kinski to stumble into frame."
Yep.
Which I totally get that, because I would say that the raw energy and madness injected into this and other performances in the film are easily comparable to the sort of intensity that Klaus Kinski tended to bring to a picture.
as I often emphasize, I think Kinski would bring a more chaotic evil energy to the proceedings, whereas I don't feel that kind of like malice in any of these performances.
No.
But I do feel that intensity. Yeah, the Kinski intensity is there.
Yeah. All right, the next actor of note, and this is a character who's more important early on. This is the character Jerzy, played by Jerzy Trela, who lived 1942 through 2022, also known in the film as the Old Man.
So this is the actor Jerzy playing the character Jerzy based on the novel written by Jerzy?
Yes, yeah, okay. And I don't think that is an accident here, because this character is the filmmaker. This is a filmmaking first wave astronaut to the alien planet who, yeah, shares his first name with the author and also seems to echo various ideas about filmmaking that align the character with the director. And he also becomes a demigod.
He's interesting in that, so we haven't gotten much into what the plot of the movie is, and there will be difficulties with ever explaining it fully. But yeah, so it is a movie about Earthlings colonizing another planet and founding a new culture there. And one thing that I think is interesting is that we see this character, Jerzy, is one of the original astronauts who creates this colony. And he is the one who remains the most aloof from the emerging culture that is created. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like he's the filmmaker, but he's also for a long time depicted as resistant to becoming fully integrated into the culture that comes into being.
Yeah, like he wants to observe, he wants to film, he doesn't speak, he becomes this person of mystery to the descendants of these first wave astronauts to the alien planet, in part because he doesn't die. He's like the oldest person anyone knows of on this
Why
world.
Why don't you die?
Yeah, so he's like this immortal, this haunted immortal that keeps filming things, but also doesn't really share anything. It stands apart from this society.
This is the character I mentioned. This seems like the only actor and character that's actually not at 11 the whole time.
Right, yeah. And he's still going to drill right into your soul with at times kind of mumbly monologues, looking right into the camera. But certainly subdued compared to the other performances. So Trela here was a Polish actor with credits going back to 1968, including 73's The Hourglass Sanatorium, 86's Gaga, Glory to the Heroes, 1994's Three Colors White, and 2001's Quo Vadis. This is a film that pops up for a number of people involved in this film. All right, the next character is, and I could be wrong on this, I believe Azal, and she is played by Grzesna Dalag, born 1954. So this character is one of the human descendants of the alien world. She becomes Merrick's lover. This is a Polish actress with credits going back to 79 and continuing on through at least 2022. Looks like she did a fair amount of German TV and cinema as well. This is another intense performance.
She's really intense and quite good. I think this is one of the characters who plays an actor and like looks into the camera and says, "What do you think about my acting?"
Yeah. So great, great performance here.
Yeah.
The next one, okay, this is the next character is a third wave human astronaut to the planet.
This character is where I start getting confused about whose relationship to what. Where is he? I don't know. We can talk about that later. But this is Jacek.
Yeah, Jacek is played by Waldemar Konowski, born 1949. Another Polish actor. He played the Witcher's father in the original Polish adaptations of the Polish Witcher fantasy novels.
Oh, okay.
So for a lot of you out there, even if you haven't seen a Polish film, you've in all likelihood seen something that originated in Polish literature of one form or another, be that something like Solaris or something like the Witcher series.
Ah, the shared DNA between On the Silver Globe and the Witcher. Wouldn't it be great if The Witcher showed up on this planet?
Oh, man. He'd find plenty to do.
He's like, "I'll take care of your Sherns for a price."
All right. The next character is Marta. Marta is a first wave human astronaut to the alien planet and ultimately, I believe, the mother to all human descendants there.
That's right. She's the Eve of the interplanetary Adam and Eve and Jerzy trio.
played by Iwona Bilska, born 1952, an award-winning actress with credits from 1978 till today, including two horror films of possible interest. One is 1983's She-Wolf, which is said to be pretty great, and 2015's The Lure, a mermaid movie that I've also read good things about.
A scary mermaid movie?
I think so. I don't know a lot about it, but I just did like preliminary glancing around, looking at some reviews, and people seem to like it. So color me interested. But anyway, her performance here as Marta, the mother of humans on this alien world, another intense performance, as we'll discuss with this character. This is basically the first wave astronauts almost immediately descend to this kind of bohemian, pagan waltz with madness. It's like going to another planet seems to just intrinsically trigger just a philosophical conundrum, to say the least, for any space traveler. You know, it's like in Event Horizon, you go into space and you turn into Hellraiser. In this movie, you travel to another planet and you are just instantly unmoored from your understanding of self or world.
Yeah, it's like you arrive on the Silver Globe and you are deeply troubled by the question of what it means to act.
Mm-hmm. All right, a couple of other actors I'll mention more in passing. I don't have extensive notes on them, but Jerzy Gralek plays Peter. Peter is the other of the three first wave human astronauts to the alien planet who seems to have the most pronounced descent into raving madness.
Though he is the primary atom of all of the colonists, so he's like the father of many of the new people on this Earth.
Yeah, and Gralek lived 1946 through 2016. Then I believe the first daughter of Marta is the character Ada, played by Elżbieta Karowska, born 1943. This is another Polish actress with extensive Polish film credits. Oh, and then we also have a character that is called the actress, because she is an actress, but not an actress on the alien world. She is an actress on Earth. Should we be calling Earth old Earth in the film? They talk about old Earth a little bit.
I mean, I've been thinking of it as Earth and the Silver Globe, I guess.
All right. So this is the denizen of Earth, and she is played by Krystyna Janda, born 1952, award-winning Polish actress, best known for 1989's Interrogation, in which she starred and won Best Actress at the Cannes Film Festival. Other films include 1986's La Puta, 1995's Pesca, and 2005's A Few People, A Little Time. She was also in the Polish sci-fi films The War of the Worlds Next Century from 1980, Synthesis from 1984, and 1985's Obi Oba, The End of Civilization.
This is the one on Earth who Jacek is her lover, and Marek was her lover, but they got rid of him by sending him to another planet.
Correct. That is okay. The primary connection between these characters. And we get to see some drama play out between her and Jacek on Earth. And she's not in it a lot, but she has this kind of like noir ice queen actress type.
Yes.
With that kind of like old fashioned hat, you know, and she also, like, everybody in this film looks visibly pale.
Yes.
In part due to, I think, just like the way they shot or processed the film. So she has a real ice queen vibe.
Yeah, she looks like she would be stumbling into the private detective's office with a cigarette and a holder saying, my husband, I need you to, but she also, there's a great scene where she's trying to run over Jacek with a car in the middle of the desert.
Oh, and yeah, that great space car, or future, dystopian future Hot Wheels car is pretty great.
I think this is the scene where Jacek says, in the end, every reduction to physiology is the fascism of the soul.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
okay. I've always thought that.
That's also where we get to, in some of these scenes, this is when we get to hear the most of the prog rock section of the score.
Bet you didn't think you'd get that, huh?
Yeah.
So it's not until the last quarter of the movie that the electric guitars come in and you get some rock music.
Yeah, and so fitting that the final person in the production we're going to talk about here is Andrzej Korzynski, who lived 1940 through 2022, highly successful Polish composer who worked with Zawowski on 11 of his films, including The Devil and Possession. So The Devil score, I listened to a little bit of this, has a kind of psychedelic rock and kind of like chaotic jazz percussion vibe to it. Mm-hmm. And Possession has, which again, I haven't seen, I just was listening to portions of the score, has like a stronger synth and disco vibe to it, but with also a lot of flute. Kind of jazz flute vibe, I guess you might call it jazz flute. I don't know, classical notes and flute. And then on the Silver Globe, I don't know, I guess you might say it leans more towards a kind of serious sci-fi ambiance for a lot of the score, but then has these very noticeable splashes of prog rock, especially later in the picture.
Nice.
Now, I don't believe this score has ever been released, but Finders Keepers Records put out The Devil just last year, and they, I think before that, I believe they put out the score of Possession. So you never know. Like it's, again, he was a highly successful, pretty famous Polish composer, and these scores are very interesting. So I think there is an audience for them.
Mm-hmm.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, is it time to talk about the plot?
Yeah, let's venture into space.
To the extent we can, let's start with some disclaimers. This is not like an just abstract art house film without a plot. The movie does have a plot. It has a concrete story that I think can, in principle, mostly be followed, but it is quite difficult to follow for reasons at multiple levels. For one thing, there's a lot of stuff in the movie that does not really advance the action, does not move the plot forward. There are the weird philosophical monologues, which are interesting, though they can themselves be difficult to follow, but they don't seem to often affect what happens between the characters moving on. They're more kind of reflections of inner thoughts that to varying extents seem connected to what's happening in the plot, though sometimes they seem totally unconnected. Another problem is who? I could not always keep the characters and their correspondences straight. I don't know if you had the same problem, but I would be wondering, like, wait, is this the same person who was just in the last scene? And sometimes I'd rewind it and try to figure it out. And other times I was just like, I don't know.
I would highly suggest having the Wikipedia plot summary for this on your phone handy just to glance at now and again. That's what I did, and I found that it helped immensely. Probably not entirely necessary, but if you're suddenly like, wait, who is this character? What is he doing? You can just sort of get up to speed, and then you're good to go.
We also have the missing segments, though we get narrative explanation to tell us what goes on there. In fact, I would say it's probably easiest to follow the parts of the plot that are just being narrated by the director, because there's less confusion about what's happening than when you're actually watching it acted out.
You know, and I didn't expect this to be the case, because the first time there was one of these segments, I was kind of like, oh man, it's a shame we don't get to see that. And, you know, what they're describing sounds very visual. By the end of the movie, there was one scene in particular that I was almost kind of glad that I didn't see, because by that point, you have been completely indoctrinated into the visual and sonic world of this picture. So anything he describes to you, you can basically simulate it in your head. You know what the characters look like. You know what the set looks like in many cases. So you can piece it together. So it weirdly like works really well later in the picture, to the point where you almost feel like you saw the scene that was missing.
I agree. And in fact, I think we should consider ourselves as reviewing not the movie that was intended to be made in 1977, but the product that exists now. The movie we're talking about is the version with these patches and the narration by Zuofsky and the modern documentary footage. That is now what On the Silver Globe is.
Yeah.
Which is another reason it's a really interesting artistic product. I mean, I don't know how I would feel about the movie if I had just seen what it was supposed to be when he was making it in 77. But to come back to other problems with recapping the plot, it's also just a conceptually confusing story to begin with, because Rob, maybe you understood this better than I did. What exactly is the time-space relationship of the astronauts in the very opening of the film that I'm going to talk about in just a minute, and also Jacek's culture to the main action of the movie that's like the colony on the Silver Globe? Are Jacek and the actress on the same planet as the others, or on a different one? They're on the same planet at some point, but do they have to travel to it? I don't know. It becomes really hard to figure out what's going on for me there.
My limited understanding is that, okay, there is contemporary Earth that we see in those missing segment portions that we talked about. But for the film proper, the story proper, we have the Silver Globe planet, and then we have Earth, or perhaps old Earth, which is a very like ruined dystopian world. Like it is a place where humanity is kind of like run out. You know, it's like there's an advanced space program that is still barely chugging along. There's a lot of ruin. New like tribal cultures have emerged on the planet. And they're also handing out some sort of weird space drug. But for the most part, I am to understand you have to use a spaceship to travel from one world to the next, with the caveat that in the latter portion of the film, it's possible you travel there by taking space drugs that the people on horseback give you. I'm not sure on that.
All right. So we cannot possibly do a more scene-by-scene talk like we do with some movies. This movie is too long, too confusing, too uncertain. There would be too much to talk about. So instead, I think what I'm going to do is kind of closely narrate the opening, and then we can zoom out and do a loose synopsis of the whole story, and then maybe zoom in on some individual elements that interested us.
All right.
So the first thing we see is wide blankets of snow over mountaintops, and we see trees the treetops of a snow-dusted conifer forest. The color palette for the whole movie is very moody and cold. It's sort of dominated by blue, green, and gray. But there is a different look when we get to the planet later. The whole thing is kind of blue, green, and gray, but the planet itself is going to feel very silvery, according to the title, I guess. But here, I think we're looking at Earth, and we see on one of the slopes covered in deep snow, surrounded by all these pine trees, a figure on horseback in a bulky, elaborate costume made of furs, pelts, feathers, and sticks is coming down the mountain. And here the narrator comes in, and this is the director, Zuofsky, talking. He says, "You will see a film made 10 years ago, a shred of a film, a 2.5-hour story, one-fifth of which is missing. That one-fifth, dating back to 1977, when the film was annihilated, will never be recreated. In place of the missing scenes, you will hear a voice which will briefly explain what was to be. We are bringing On the Silver Globe to an end in the year 1987. So again, there's this meta commentary, these almost documentary comments within the movie itself now in the form we have it. So on screen, the figure on horseback makes it down the mountain to a flat expanse. And the horse starts to gallop. And the rider's face we don't see. It's covered in a large gray mask. And the figure rides into the courtyard of an empty, dilapidated Polish palace where more figures are dressed in the same style and they're encamped there. And one interesting thing is we see the hearth. There's like a campfire burning and the flames are green. What did you make of that, Rob?
Oh, yeah, the green flames. I mean, on one level, yeah, the way that the film was filtered or shot, you know, everything has this kind of sort of a bluish tint to it, I guess, this pale blue tint. But also within the context of the film, it feels like, well, this is maybe the fire of an alien, or in this case, perhaps an altered world. Mm-hmm. Because again, Earth itself in this film seems to be a dystopian, at least semi post-apocalyptic world. Mm-hmm. Things have not gone well here. It is a world in decline. And to a large extent, that is also the case we will find out concerning the Silver Globe. It is also a world in decline, populated by a native species that seems to be in decline as well. So maybe fire's just green now.
Yeah, I almost took it as something about the atmosphere of the world at this point. Anyway, the rider dismounts and runs up the stairs inside the palace and bursts into this big empty room where two men are resting on cots. And the men here are dressed in a totally different style of clothing from the rest of the camp. All the other people at the camp are dressed in these pelts and feathers and these haunting opaque masks. The two men here are dressed in dirty, well-worn green jumpsuits. They look like, you know, employees of a space center in the science fiction future.
Yeah, yeah. And again, to be clear, this is Earth. This may not be clear when you're first watching the film, but this is a dilapidated Earth.
Right. So these two guys receive the rider, and the rider presents them with an object wrapped in furs that was found in the mountains and brought down with great haste. It is something that should be of interest to them. It's an artifact made of metal, and it looks like it could be part of a spaceship or satellite. A few interesting things about this scene. The people here who are dressed sort of like astronauts, even though they're on Earth, are obviously like foreigners living among these people. So the rider's people are dressed in this elaborate kind of beautiful clothing, and they speak a different language that the astronauts here must translate. And the people are treating the astronauts almost like guests, but there is a division between them. One of the astronauts, the younger one, seems to have kind of a warm relationship with the people, while the older guy does not. The younger man seems to maybe have a relationship with one of the women in the group, but the older man gives the people some kind of pellets or pills that they desire, though he says his supply will eventually run out. And the older guy seems to regard these people with suspicion. He worries that they're going to tamper with his equipment and damage the electronics, which would be catastrophic for them. And he sort of speaks with scorn about the younger man's relationship with the other people. So when I was first watching this, the way I interpreted it was, oh, okay, these are astronauts on an alien planet, and they're having this tense kind of different or difficult relationship with the locals, who seem to be treating them well, but it's complicated. And so that was one way that sort of made a kind of sense. But then as I realized more as the plot developed, I realized, like, no, these are people on Earth.
Yeah, that's right. It seems to be the case in this film, both on Earth and then ultimately on the alien planet, that that humanity has a tendency to descend into this kind of like bohemian, new pagan tribal structure of life with brilliant costuming.
Yes.
It is just important to stress how glorious all of the costuming in this film is. Just everything that is worn is grimy and perfectly fitting of the atmosphere and the character, be it the feather festooned and garments of these riders, or even the pristine spacesuits of the space travelers, and then also the garments that the descendants of the space travelers end up wearing on the alien world. Clearly, a great deal of work and creativity went into the costuming on this picture.
Oh, yeah. The costumes are an absolute highlight. But anyway, so coming back to the scene, so there's a dispute about the origin of this object that the writer brought them. The writer says that they saw it fall from the sky during the night just 2 days ago. But one of the guys in the astronaut suit says that's impossible. This thing looks like it was launched into space. You know, it was burned. We can see how it was burned in the rocket launch process. And that would mean it had to be 50 or 60 years old. So it sounds like they're saying, you know, there hasn't been a rocket launch in 50 or 60 years. But then they sort of process it. They seem concerned. They're like, if it really is recent, what does that mean? So they decide that the artifact must be analyzed. And when it is analyzed, it will contain some kind of recording. So they suit up to travel outside, where it is freezing, by the way. They put on these ghoulish gas masks. And they go out, passing by what looks like an airfield with pulsing lights on the runway. And then there is a hatch that they use to access an underground bunker. Now, here we reach the first missing scene. We cannot follow the actors into the bunker because that film was either lost or never shot. So instead, the narrator comes in to tell us what happens. The narrator says, under the hatchway into which the two astronauts enter, there is a lab, a huge room filled with machines that listen to the sounds from outer space. And then meanwhile, on the screen, we are shown contemporary footage of crowds moving through what looks like an airport or a subway tunnel in 1980s Poland. And the camera glides over the floor of this huge windowless passageway at about knee height, just looking up at hundreds of busy strangers as they walk on without noticing. And then the narration goes on saying, only one of the oldest machines, which has remained idle for decades, can read out what is inside the container which the astronauts received from the writer. It is a diary, or rather, a series of semi-transparent plates featuring screens as if shot with a camera. The first shows the journey of a spacecraft, the pilots losing control, crashing it into the mountains. Only a fragment of this recording survives. And then we cut to the inside of a spacecraft cockpit, with astronauts in full suits and helmets strapped into their seats in cramped quarters with this just hell of wires protruding everywhere. And the spacecraft is shaking and rattling. It's obviously going through, you know, it's a bumpy ride. And then something happens. The cockpit starts to fill with what looks like white foam. It's like a bubble bath in there. And one of the astronauts silently writes the word death in chalk on the inner wall of the fuselage. Now, I thought this was interesting because Zuofsky tells us in the narration that only a fragment of this recording survives, and then shows us this moment from the spacecraft crashing. But since within the plot, the characters are looking at a degraded film record of events in the past, I think it's genuinely ambiguous whether Zuofsky is saying that only a fragment of this part of his film on the Silver Globe survives, and it's this clip that we're about to see, or that the clip is supposed to be only a fragment which survives of the video diary of the semi-transparent plates within the plot. And in fact, I would say this is not the only way in which the events of the story have weird overlaps with the circumstances of the production and restoration and release.
Yeah, it ends up creating a complex tapestry here.
Anyway, we learn through more narration that the spacecraft crashes on a mountaintop on this other planet, an Earth-like planet, which was chosen for its ability to support life. This mission was not just one of exploration, but of colonization. You almost get the sense that the astronauts are trying to escape something on Earth. They're here to start a new life, but I don't know, Rob, did you have the same feeling that it's almost like you wonder if, was this sanctioned? Is this a sanctioned colonization attempt? Or are these astronauts who just managed to get hold of a spaceship and leave on their own accord?
Hard to say, yeah, because it feels like Earth is in bad shape. And there's not like a strong, like central command center that is really in touch with the mission once it is sent off. Communication between Earth and the Silver Globe is very tenuous. Yeah. So I don't know that this was necessarily a state-sponsored mission so much. But we do learn a little bit more about it as we proceed.
So the commander of the mission is killed in the crash and his body is left behind. And at some point we see, I think there are multiple of the crew's remains they end up doing this for, but they create a kind of mountaintop tomb for him. That's like a big pile of rocks on which the body is left. And for some reason up in this upper mountain area, maybe because it's so arid, the body doesn't really decay. Like we come back and see these bodies later on the mountaintop and they become like preserved, like the body of linen or something up there. And they are visited later in a religious sense.
Yeah.
Another one of the astronauts on this mission, Tomasz, survives but is badly injured. And here we see haunting, barren landscapes as the astronauts look down from a mountain into the silver valleys all around. I think this is probably part of the film that was filmed in the Gobi Desert, like in mm-hmm. Mongolia.
Yeah, I believe so. It was breathtaking locations.
Yeah. And the narrator tells us while we look at footage of houses and rooftops shot from the window of a passing car in modern Poland, that the astronauts see another rocket ship crash into the mountains nearby and explode. And they wonder, quote, were those who died in it with them or after them? I don't know. Intriguing question. Mm-hmm. But they come down from the mountains in a couple of surface exploration buggies. These are big all-terrain vehicles, and they're heading toward the ocean. They think they want to set up their colony on the beach with access to the sea. And on the way, they pass a formation of rocks that looks deliberately piled together, quote, like an architectural form, as if this apparently empty planet had once been home to a civilization long in the past. And we will learn that maybe it is still home to a civilization that they don't know about. Then the narrator tells us that in missing footage, the injured astronaut, Tomasz, hallucinates while riding in back of one of these buggies across the desert. He believes that he sees the ghosts of dead astronauts trying to capture him and chain him up. For what purpose? He doesn't know. That is one missing scene I kind of wish we had. I would like mm-hmm. to see the astronaut ghosts.
Be like an adaptation of Pac-Man.
Also, the other astronauts are a woman named Marta and two men named Piotr and Jerzy. So we watch them swing between bouts of ecstasy and terror in their new environment. The philosophical monologues begin almost immediately, and they are raving about the divine potential of human nature, like, what is the seed of man? If the seed has a sense to it, it is an animal. If the seed has reasoning to it, it is a man. If the seed has intellect to it, it is an angel or the son of man. And I was like trying to follow this at first. I was like, what exactly is he talking about? And then I just had to get used to like, oh, it's just going to be like this.
Yeah, a lot of it is just going to sort of roll off of your brain. But in a way, it's like poetic lyrics to a song that you're maybe not supposed to really understand beat for beat. Mm-hmm. But if you sort of pick up on half of it, I feel like you're probably doing pretty well. I don't know if the experience is different if you were a native a Polish speaker and this film is speaking directly to you without translation and subtitles. But certainly I would love to hear from anyone out there who has had that experience. But I don't know. I have my doubts. I feel like the contents of these monologues are so thick and philosophical and poetic that it would be difficult to follow everything beat by beat unless you had multiple viewings of this film.
I agree with that.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
So the narrative continues to cut between lost segments that are narrated by Zuofsky and filmed shots of the actors struggling with conditions on the planet. They're at one point hit by a hurricane and swept into a flood current, nearly drowned. Then they are stranded on a vast mud flat with Marta, quite movingly, still clutching Tomash's dead body after he passes away. So, like, the implication is that she clung to him the whole time they were struggling to survive the flood. Again, most of this part of the movie seems to be shot in point of view shots. Like, these are the video diaries that we saw being received from space earlier. And I guess here is a good point to kind of zoom out and recap the plot with a little more distance. So what happens after this is that the remaining astronauts, Marta, Pyotr, and Jerzy, will go on to found an extraterrestrial kind of Swiss Family Robinson base on the beach of this world. So we see them building, or in fact, we don't see a lot of the building process. They just suddenly have these like huts and structures and underground layers, these tunnels they've dug out and fence posts, and they have tools and weapons, and they have clothing that they've created. They start to sort of change their appearance to be, I don't know, like they make tattoos and markings on their faces and their skin, and they wear these new styles, and they set about having children. They become a sort of Adam and Eve trio of this new generation of humans. So they learn that the humans born on the new planet grow and mature at an accelerated pace. It's something about the planet and its atmosphere, I guess. So it seems that within a few years, the children, the first generation of children they have, are already reaching adulthood. And then again, sort of like the Adam and Eve story, there is an unrealistic proliferation of new humans from these three progenitors. With, you know, they don't really get into this deeply, but a lot of implied incest.
Mythological incest.
Yes. So the astronauts and the children that grow up on the Silver Globe, interestingly, do not seem to reproduce the Earth culture that they come from. And instead, they create a new Neolithic culture with their own emerging styles of clothing and art, their own technology, and their own religious beliefs and customs. And this is what I thought was one of the most interesting things about the movie. It was just the idea that, like, so they land, and I think what you normally see in a sci-fi movie is just that, like, adults land on another planet and they are enculturated in the culture they come from, and they just sort of like reproduce that in the new place. But here instead, they're shown like making a new, previously non-existent human culture from scratch.
Yeah, there's like a break from the previous culture. You know, it's like almost like visiting the other planet is in and of itself an intense psychedelic experience that completely changes how you relate to yourself and your world. And so, yeah, they seem to just sort of create wholesale this new like pagan bohemian society. Like you said, they start engaging in all these different forms of face painting and or tattoos, intricate braiding of hair and so forth.
There's one thing I love of what they do with the bodies of the dead. Like, there is this little island off the shore of the beach where they live, and the island has these huge standing stones on it, like the offshore Stonehenge. Mm-hmm. And I don't know exactly how that was created or if they found it that way, but it becomes a kind of island of the dead where,
yeah,
after Piotr and Marta die, I think Jerzy, the one remaining original astronaut, now the old man who's revered as kind of a prophet and a demigod by the new generations of humans, their children, he takes the bodies of the other two dead astronauts and puts them back into their astronaut suits, which they have not been wearing, and then takes them out to this island of the dead with the standing stones and leaves them there. Is that what happened?
I believe so, yeah. And now that you mention Island of the Dead, like, it's not, you know, one-to-one looking like Buchlin's Isle of the Dead painting, but there is something to the asymmetry of the island that does kind of match up with that painting. So I don't know, I don't know if this is a reference to that painting or that painting and this particular shot are both sort of referencing the same thing, like deep in the bowels of the human mind.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it some point around here after Marta and Piotr die that some of the Silver Globe humans lead an expedition across the ocean in canoes to see what's on the other side?
Yeah.
And then only one of them comes back alive, saying they were attacked by something over the water, I think.
Yeah, divisions begin to occur. You know, there seem to be like a faction that are like, we're good here. And the other faction is like, we need to cross the ocean and see what's there, claim what's there. You know, they're expansionist. But only one comes back because there are like cities of stone there, vast cities, and there are these winged creatures, and they killed most of us. And so, now we have a hint of some sort of indigenous civilization here, some sort of alien life form. And so far, first contact has not gone well.
There's also a section in here, I think it's a little earlier, where there are random explosions everywhere.
Yes.
That are never explained, but just, I love the effects. They're just like, you know, explosives planted under the soil. So they just start popping up from the beach and the surrounding land and the forest. It's just exploding and you never understand why.
Yeah, it's just a weird alien world where we don't know if this is seismic chemical or if it's, you know, stuff falling from the sky, but it creates chaos and death.
Before the final of the astronauts, before Jersey dies, he makes a pilgrimage to the mountaintop where the astronauts originally landed. And I think this is when he sends off his video diaries to return to Earth.
Mm-hmm. Which is, I guess, what they're talking about having received at the top of the picture.
That's how I took it as well.
Yeah.
So a new batch of astronauts from Earth, they receive this message and some are sent to the planet. Maybe just one is sent or multiple are sent. I don't know. We only really encounter one. And that is Marek, played by Andre Severin, who is going to become sort of the main character of the movie going forward. When Marek arrives, he is welcomed by a religious order that has arisen among the humans, and he is treated as a long prophesied messiah figure. And it's going to fall to Marek to lead the humans against a terrifying and mysterious alien enemy known as the Shurns. Mm. Now, what are the Shurns? Oh boy, I loved the Shurns. They were so creepy. It's kind of unclear to me exactly what their origin is. I think they are just supposed to be the indigenous inhabitants of this planet, but it also seemed possible to me that they were created by humans in some unclear way. I don't know exactly.
Yeah, they are some sort of humanoid bird person that was slash perhaps still is capable of flight. And they also are psychic. They have some sort of telepathic abilities. And in this, I feel like this might have been partially inspired by the writings of Edgar Rice Burroughs, where we have, at one point, we have a psychic winged alien species that features into the plots of some of his worlds. But yeah, these creatures have some sort of telepathic ability. And also later on, we learn some sort of like cybernetic enhancement that is a part of how they are expressed.
Yeah.
There will be monologues about this.
Yeah. Oh, but you know, you could get the wrong idea by hearing that these are bird-like creatures, because you might be imagining like big, beautiful, feathery wings, and it's not quite like that. It's more like they are humanoids draped in shaggy, mottled cloth and caked in mud, hobbling stiffly around on 2 feet, sort of like scarecrows with heads covered by scary burlap bags. They're covered in, you know, just filth and cobwebs, but they do have hidden bird-like anatomy underneath it all. So they have like sort of angel wings coming off of their backs, and then the lump of a beak just protruding in the front of the face, but always, like I said, sort of under a burlap sack or something. And then these dark recesses that contain no visible eyes. They are so creepy looking.
Yeah, reminded me, there's a certain Skeksis-esque quality to them. And they also reminded me of the Beast from the 1978 Czech Beauty and the Beast film that we watched for Weird House a while back.
So at this point, the Shurns are a hated foe of the humans on the Silver Globe. They are oppressing and enslaving the humans. And then I think also they are mating with humans to create a type of terrible hybrid offspring called the Mortes, which seem to function kind of like undead soldiers almost.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a scene later on where we see a whole bunch of them together that have been kind of like collected and imprisoned.
So anyway, the new astronaut, Marek, is brought into the culture and politics of the human faction here. There is the woman named Hazel, who is destined by prophecy to be his lover, I think. But she's also like an actress and is brilliantly acting out the part that has been prophesied for her. But then they do genuinely fall in love with each other. And then there are priests and monks who I sort of understood as each trying to manipulate Marek for his perceived power. Mm-hmm. We also see Marek presiding over battles against the Mortes and the Shurns, riding what looks like a parade float through the middle of the field of combat while his adoring minions slay their enemies.
Yeah, there's a lot of religious zeal and this feeling of just of a crusade here that at times made me think of Dune the rise of the Messiah character in Dune, the rise of Paul Atreides. And as Muad'Dib. And so, there's a frenzied energy to this. It's like getting everybody worked up to go on these campaigns against the Shern. So it's really like splendid cinematic stuff. I should also note that there are a number of scenes here that take place in some sort of vast cave complex.
Oh, yeah. I think it was shot in an abandoned salt mine.
Ah, that absolutely makes sense because you see, like parts of the cavern are augmented clearly, and you see clear human structures of some sort, but in a very like alien, decayed way that works perfectly for the film.
Yeah, there are beautiful, beautiful, ugly sets in these caves and in the mines that are so good, and just generally, this movie chooses the locations of its shots very well. It's almost always framed in an interesting place. And it's interesting the way that these settings seem to have changed the culture of the humans, because we see them doing stuff down in the subterranean settings that we don't see them doing above. Like in the subterranean setting is where they keep their prisoners. Like they take the leader of the Sherns prisoner and they've got him captive there, and they've got all these Mortes as prisoners. But it's also the only place we see the humans like engaging in orgies. There seems to be some kind of ritual orgy going on that's like hundreds of people sort of writhing about naked on the ground with their bodies like painted gray and blue.
I think, and I may be wrong in this, but I think the idea is that these are humans who have been like psychically touched by the Shern in some way that is like, they've kind of just fallen off into just unending desire. And they're like writhing on the floor of the cavern in a way that feels like directly inspired by the Gustave Doré illustrations for Dante's Inferno. And I believe Purgatory as well. Maybe I'm more specifically thinking of scenes from Purgatory.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can see that link.
At one point, we have characters walk across them, even. Like, they are not only on the floor, but they are the floor of the cavern.
Yeah, yeah. So, as I said in this section, Marek does fall in love with Ihazal, but he also seems plagued by bad memories of failed relationships on Earth. And as you alluded to earlier, this character, Marek, is always operating right at the brink of madness. Like, he is giving these incredibly powerful, passionate monologues, but he is not doing well emotionally.
Yeah, from the get-go.
So Marek eventually leads his forces in an assault on the Shern homeland across the sea, which strangely looks like it could be the war-torn ruins of a Polish city.
Yeah, it is. It definitely has that feel to it. And, obviously that was probably more or less how they shot it. They used some sort of like fittingly gray section of some Polish city, and they just dirtied and grimed it up a lot. But I guess it's fitting for the film in that it's, again, even the world of the Silver Globe is a world in decline. Like, Shern civilization is in decline. There's at least at some point mentioned that they have lost the ability to fly. Am I remembering that correctly? Yeah. Though then there are instances where they do fly. So it's like one civilization in decline attempting to topple another civilization in decline on this strange world.
Yeah. But also Marek is strangely affected by like the persuasive powers of the Sherns. Like the Shern leader who he captures and talks to kind of gets in his head in a way. And when he's on campaign attacking the Shern homeland, he has these weird moments where I don't know exactly how to interpret everything emotionally, but like there's a part that we don't get to fully see, but it is told to us in one of the narrated segments that he goes into like a cathedral in the Shern city, and the cathedral is full of these like lock boxes containing Shern brains. So what's going on here?
Something to do with the complex nature of Shern existence, that they are augmented cybernetic beings. Maybe the brains are from another species and the brains are like remotely controlling the bird bodies. I don't know. It's very complex. I wish we would have gotten those brain scenes.
Yeah, me too.
But yeah, it is. It's a lot. Now, that being said, just because the Schirn set Merrick off, everything seems to set Merrick off. Like, yeah. If you were to ask Merrick, do you want cream and sugar with your coffee? It would probably result in a 15-minute monologue about, to put the coffee in the cream into the coffee is to make my coffee into something that I did not have before. And it would keep going on. And it would just be at the edge of just complete collapse the whole time.
I don't know if the monologue would even mention coffee. It might set off a monologue. It was like, in order to understand you, must I destroy you?
Yep.
Also, okay, so there's the campaign part. When Merrick eventually returns to the Earthling colony across the sea, after the attempted conquest, he finds the beach, full of heretics impaled on stakes. There is an Inquisition going on, and he is next. And then we work our way up to the final, the final set piece of the movie, which is that Marek gets crucified.
If there is like a bingo card for extravagant art house epics, I feel like this is definitely on there, like crucifixion of central character. And it's bloody and horrifying, though it does come after the scene where we encounter like a good dozen or so heretics impaled on the beach in what is a grisly scene. Like, at this point, we're over 2 hours into the film. We've seen a lot. We've seen a lot of blood and stuff. But this I was not quite prepared for how grisly these sections are.
And at least one of the impaled guys is a real actor. I mean, not they actually impaled him, but they have him up on a really high up stake sitting there and delivering lines. I don't know how they achieved that effect.
Yeah, not to get too graphic, but these poles that they're impaled on are like dripping with the ruptured entrails of the people who have been impaled. It's very graphic. And yet there's like this kind of almost Monty Python-esque, I'm not dead yet, kind of vibe to it, because you have a guy on top of this thing giving an extended monologue. And then another similar feel when we get our main character hauled up on a form of a crucifix.
Now, there's something I haven't even mentioned yet, which is that the last like third to a quarter of the movie, while the Marek plot is going on, it's also intercutting with the plot of the actress and Yasik, who are, I think they are lovers, and the actress was once Marek's partner, but they sent Marek away to another planet so that she and Yasik could be together.
Yeah, there was like a love triangle, and the solution was to send him off. He comes to the planet, becomes its savior, but then at the same time on the planet, he's returned from this campaign across the ocean. And I believe it's implied that the campaign has not been entirely successful.
Yeah.
It has perhaps been, you could perhaps view it more accurately as a retreat. Yeah. And at this point, there is definitely a schism in the culture here on the Silver Globe, where some people are saying, I don't think he is the savior. And I've kind of got this vibe that he did not come here. He was exiled here.
Right.
And that's why you have all these heretics impaled on the beach.
Right. There's this other religious figure who we are told says that Marek was not sent to them as a savior. He is a worm expelled from below. Mm. But then, I forget how this even happens. Somehow Yasik and the actress arrive on the Silver Globe planet, and they're there like with the other humans for the crucifixion in the end. And there's they take on kind of religious, the trappings of religious figures.
Yeah. I could not find a really adequate explanation of this. I looked around and I found other people online trying to figure this out as well. Like, do they travel on a spaceship and we just don't see it? Maybe. Do they just take weird drugs and magically travel here? Possibly. There might be some third option I'm missing, but at any rate, they arrive.
I just wanted to mention a frame that I included right here at the end for us, Rob, which is toward the end of the movie, one character. Wait, is this the character of the actress who is shown with with like a flesh-eating disease at the end?
Oh, I thought this was Azel.
Oh, okay. It might be. Okay.
Yeah. Assuming I'm correct here, she has some sort of a strange kind of like space leprosy thing going on. That's, grotesque and beautiful at the same time.
Yeah. And so she has that. She wears like a veil over her face, but it's uncovered, and she has these sores. And then Jacek is just standing there next to her and says, how much can one endure? And I have to feel like maybe that was the director talking about both the making of the movie and your watching of it.
Yeah, how much can one endure? About, 166 minutes?
There's so much we haven't talked about, but I feel like we've got to cut it off at some point. So I think maybe we're getting there. I don't know if you have anything else you want to hit on.
Oh, I mean, I just have to say, again, it's the costuming, the setting, the just exhausting in a good way performances, you know. It's just that there's so much creative energy went into this thing. And, you know, thank goodness it survived. What a tragedy it would have been if all of this work, regardless of the quality of the final film, or what we have of the final film, if all of that work had gone to waste and an audience didn't get to experience it, you know?
Yeah.
But I do think that the result here, it's, again, I was never bored throughout the whole thing. At times I was exhausted and certainly challenged by the content, but it is a phenomenal film viewing experience. And I do recommend it to anyone out there who likes a weird jaunt into just another cinematic realm.
It might not be for everyone, but it is a remarkable piece of filmmaking.
Absolutely. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and close it out here, but we'd love to hear from everyone out there. Do you have a past concerning On the Silver Globe, or perhaps a future concerning On the Silver Globe? Write in. We would love to hear from you. Also, you know, certainly, especially with this being our first Polish film, if we have, you know, listeners from Poland or Polish descent, or just, you know, film fans who have more familiarity with Polish cinema than we do, write in. We'd love to hear from you about this movie or about, you know, other films from Polish cinema and Polish creators, directors, and featuring Polish actors that we might consider in the future. Yeah, we'd love to hear it. Just as a reminder, Stuff to Blow Your Mind is primarily a science podcast feed with core episodes of the podcast on Tuesdays and Thursdays, dealing with topics, you know, scientific and cultural. On Mondays, we do listener mail. On Wednesdays, we do a short form episode. And on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns to just talk about a weird film on Weird House Cinema. If you want to see a list of all the films we've covered over the years, go to letterboxd.com. That's letterboxd.com. It's a fun website for film fans in general, but we have a profile there. Our profile name is Weird House, and we have a list of everything we've covered and sometimes a peek ahead at what's coming out next.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.